Are you ready?
I guess so. You got an intro planned and everything?
I don't have anything planned at all.
I think what we should do is we should yawn, like, really loud. Like, whoa.
Oof. Because we've been away for so long? Yeah. Like, we've been sleeping? Like, Ichabod Crane or something?
Yeah. Rip Van Winkle.
Yeah. I didn't think about that for a second. Ichabod Crane was the headless horseman guy. Yeah. You're right. Oh, you're totally right. All right. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to the first revamped episode of whatever we decide to call this podcast.
It's not setting the frame.
Well, the idea was that it would be ours. Setting the frame is my thing.
Okay.
You know, that it would be our thing.
Setting our frames.
We're setting their frames, hopefully.
Okay.
You know, adjusting their viewpoint with our knowledge.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Okay, well, yeah.
We're going to bit of silence.
Who are you?
Hey, I'm Cesar Alejandro Jr. I am a writer for FilmSmash.com, which is an Asian cinema film site, news and reviews. Who are you?
And I'm CJ Talbot, and I have a little blog called Setting the Frame that rarely gets updated. Some of you may know it. Some of you may...
I read it.
Some of you may pass over things when I post them and don't read them, and that's okay, too.
I read them.
Yeah.
I care.
Well, you and my mom. That's and sometimes my wife. So, okay. I have three fans.
I wouldn't say fan.
Okay. All right.
I read them.
That's par for the course anyway. Yeah, that was terrible.
This is rough. Holy
shit. We're going to keep going anyway, so who cares? So we're going to be talking about The Hustler.
Okay.
For this podcast.
Yep.
But, you know, first, since we haven't done this in a long time, it's, you know, what have you been watching? What's good? What's out there? What's going on in your life?
I guess most recently I saw Ron at the Senator 2 days ago. Yesterday. It's a classic. I probably hadn't seen that film for around 10 years, since whenever Criterion first released it on DVD. I want to say it's around 10 years
ago. That's the one that's based on King Lear, right?
It is.
Yeah, yes. I've never seen it.
Color,
right?
It is in color, yeah.
Yeah.
French and Japanese co-production. So.
Okay.
It's, you know, excellent film. I mean, it's quite long. It's got...
Is that Toshirô Mifune?
No, Tatsuya Nakadai. Who is, I guess, like, if you could say De Niro was Scorsese's original, like, go-to actor... Lear DiCaprio is like his go-to actor these days. It's kind of like that same relationship.
Okay.
Professionally.
So Mifune was his early muse and this guy was his later muse?
I don't know. Muse maybe not, instrument more like, okay. I guess. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but Tatsuya Nakadai, I think he's one of those guys that doesn't nearly get as much credit, but he's been in some of Kurosawa's greatest films as well.
Is he in, I'm going to say this wrong, Kagemusha?
Kagemusha?
Yeah. That one.
Oh, gosh. You know, I haven't seen that movie in a long time. It's probably been, like, almost 20 years since I've seen that film, though.
All
right. Yeah, Tatsuya Nakadai's been a lot of Hideo Gosha films. He does genre as well as... He still acts to this day. He's quite old, but around his 90s. But he's pretty damn spry.
Okay.
I was lucky enough...
How is it?
Kagemusha.
Kagemusha. Okay. Yeah. Thank you.
He might be the last great elder statesman of cinema, of Japanese cinema, still alive these days.
Okay, cool. Anything else?
Besides that...
Was that a film print or was it DCI?
It was DCI.
Yeah.
Yeah. They said...
everything's DCI
these days. I'm not sure exactly, but, you know, it was marked as a 4K restoration. I'm sure that wasn't a print.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we saw Dial-In for Murder the week before.
Yes.
In 3D at the Senator, mm-hmm. which was great. So, I hadn't seen that movie for a long time. Ray Milan is great. And
I've never seen it.
Yeah.
At the time.
I remember you telling me that. That was surprising, because that's one of the big ones, you know.
I'd say Ron is one of the big ones, too.
Yeah. Touche. All right. Well, I, yeah, I think we should just dive into this thing, man.
Okay.
All right. So, so
that's it. Just Dahlem's,
we can keep talking about Dahlem for Murder.
No. Okay, well, I mean, like, what else have you been watching then?
Well, I think I mentioned this to you the other day. I watched the first movie in that Nikatsu Noir Eclipse series set.
Oh yeah,
I Am Waiting.
Yeah,
which was good. I didn't love it. Takes a while to get going, but the last half I really enjoyed quite a bit.
Yeah, the best is still to come, I think. So
from that set,
yeah,
yeah. Well, Rusty Knife is next, and I'll be diving into that sometime soon. Mm-hmm. So, looking forward to it.
All right.
So, you know, obviously I watched The Hustler recently, since we're going to talk about it.
Yeah.
And
that doesn't count. You're going to hear all about it.
Yeah. Well, so, well, what is The Hustler?
Well, evidently, The Hustler was originally a novel, I guess.
Yes.
Written by a guy, I can't remember his first name, something worse on. Who I think
Robert Rossen directed it.
Rossen, yeah. Is that the correct pronunciation? It's not.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's about a pool hustler named Fast Eddie, played by Paul Newman, who is on a search for Minnesota Fats. So he sets out about making a name for himself until he's able to get a game going with the legendary Minnesota Fats, who is, I guess, in the world of fictional billiards, is one of the greatest players out there.
Yep.
And in doing so, he gets his match, but then things spiral a little bit out of his control afterwards, in the aftermath.
Well, the original book is by Walter Tevis, The Hustler. It was released by 20th Century Fox, 1961. It is a black and white film, and it is in CinemaScope, which is a rare thing for a black and white movie.
Yeah, definitely, when I watched it, I was definitely surprised to see the ratio on it. That was one of the first things I noticed.
Yes,
yeah,
2.35 scope. The cinematographer was, and I don't know if I'm going to say this right or not, but Eugen Schuften. You know, it's beautiful cinematography. It won the Oscar for best cinematography that year, and which I think was definitely helped tremendously by the editing work by D.D. Allen, who also edited Dog Day Afternoon, which is a movie that we're going to be doing on an upcoming episode.
Hopefully.
So you know, Paul Newman is a very talented pool player, hungry to prove himself and gain money and you know, be appreciated for his talents and become, you know, he considers himself one of the best pool players in the world. But the only way to be the best is to beat the best, and so that he and his friend Charlie have to go across country to play Minnesota Fats at Ames's Billiards in New York City. The entire movie was shot in New York City on location, with the exception of a couple scenes that were shot inside a studio, but the studio was in New York City as well. So the whole thing is shot in New York. And it's a terrific movie. Paul Newman, it should be said, I guess. Do you know much about Paul Newman's early career?
Maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, like, honestly,
not
like,
before this.
Yeah, maybe. I'm definitely more familiar with later Newman works. He was in a movie called The Silver Chalice for Fox, which apparently was terrible and did not do well financially and almost ruined his career.
Maybe we should watch this film though.
And so he did a couple of other movies, and he was supposed to be doing a movie with Elizabeth Taylor. Cat on a Hot Tin Roof he did before The Hustler, and that was the movie that sort of put him back in the good graces, and people, critics, really liked him in that movie. He was supposed to do another movie with Elizabeth Taylor, and so he turned The Hustler down initially, and Elizabeth Taylor was doing Cleopatra at the time, and that shoot ran so long that it freed Newman up, because Cleopatra took a precedent over this smaller film, and they could not have Elizabeth Taylor for the film that he was going to do with her, which I can't remember the name of it. So that freed Newman up, and he was able to say yes to do The Hustler. And thankfully he did, because this, for me, is one of his defining roles. So.
Which I would say so. I mean, he's tremendous in this film.
Yeah.
I think, well, I mean, all around, I think there's pretty great performances by everyone involved. Piper Laurie, George C. Scott. I think, you know, we mentioned earlier, I'd never seen this before, but, you know, I definitely felt that was a disservice to, like, you know, not having seen that before now.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, it's one of the great movies, I think, about gambling and about hustling in general. I mean, there are other movies about hustling that aren't about pool. This movie came out a couple of years and was very successful. So, The Cincinnati Kid, which is a poker movie with Steve McQueen and Edward G. Robinson, came out a couple of years later, which was really, you know, a result of the success of this movie. And they tried to sort of recreate the dynamic of the young card sharp and the older, you know, more respected player, and kind of put them head to head, you know, in that film. And it was not nearly as successful. And it's really not a very good movie. It's sort of a footnote in both their careers. We discussed when we started talking about, you know, doing a podcast again, we discussed, you know, a handful of movies that we wanted to do, and, you know, The Hustler was one that I suggested. So, you know, thank you for agreeing to do that. But I also suggested White Man Can't Jump, which I think is another, you know, if you look at modern movies about hustling, I think that's one of the best ones too. So apparently I have a thing for gambling
for the con and
hustling
and the grift.
You know, the short con. So maybe we'll get to that in a later episode. We'll talk more about it today. Who knows?
A grifting retrospective.
Yeah. You know, you had not seen this movie before. I grew up loving this movie. And
when was the first time you'd seen it?
I have no idea. I can't recall. But I saw this movie, you know, probably on Turner Classics or some, you know, some cable channel when I was fairly young, probably still in elementary school. And we had not had a pool table in my home yet. But it was this movie, and I had an uncle who threw a big party every New Year's Eve, and we would go to Uncle Ross's house, and he had a pool table in his basement, and I loved, you know, watching the adults play pool, and they kind of wouldn't let us play a lot.
You're a dumb kid. You're going to screw up the felt.
Yeah. Like, well, they would kind of, like, you know, every couple of hours they'd be like, all right, let's let the kids play a game. And they would let us play a game, and then they would kick us off again, and they would, you know, play more serious pool. And my dad was very good.
I've heard stories, yeah.
I don't want to embellish.
I've heard stories.
You know, I mean, you know, my dad was, he played when he was younger. He was very good. You know, there is a story that he likes to tell about, you know, beating the Maryland State champ at the time. And he was spotted a ball. So he won, but it was kind of like, there was a point spread. but he, you know, I mean, he kicked my ass for years and years and years, even, you know, I mean, his eyes aren't so great anymore, but towards the end, when I was graduating high school and before I had moved out and gone on my own, he was still a very formidable player. Like, you know, if he put his glasses on, I knew I was in for it. So
it's like Blade when he loses his glasses, puts the glasses on, comes unstoppable.
I got to be pretty good. I played around, you know, with friends and things like that. And, you know, to be honest, I don't think I was ever as good as maybe he was in his prime. And, I played here and there, but, you know, I was no, Fast Eddie Felsen or Minnesota Fats. we ended up getting a pool table, so I would watch The Hustler or Star Wars in the background while I was shooting pool for hours and hours and hours, for a long time, you know, learning the game and just practicing different English on the ball. And, so going back, and I had not seen this movie for a really long time, actually, you know, I felt like I knew it really well, but watching it again now, and seeing it through the eyes of an adult, you know, a 40-year-old man, as opposed to a younger person or a teenager, you know, I felt like I was seeing it new again in a way. So it was great. So I'm glad we're talking about it. What were the things that struck you about it the most, you know, having seen it just for the first time?
Well, I mean, certainly, like, visually, it's a pretty impressive film. There's a handful of shots that, like, stick in my head, even, I guess, maybe half a week after seeing the film. Like, one of the shots that really is memorable to me is there's a scene where, I guess it's after he first meets Piper Laurie, where he goes back to, like, the little dinette area, and, like, he's sitting at the table where I guess he was sitting earlier, or that she was sitting at, but he's, like, framed to the right of the... He's on the right of the frame, and then you just see, like, the entire wall, and he's very small in that scene. And, you know, I mean, the movie's filled with shots like that, where...
It's funny you mention how he's framed in the scene, because, like, something that I never would have noticed as a kid, but now I notice as I become more sophisticated in my viewing, is that Newman's always framed below Minnesota Fats and Bert in the film until the very last scene. So, like, even in three shots, like, there's a shot where, like, on the train... with Bert, Sarah, and Eddie, where Sarah is framed below Eddie, but Bert is still framed above him. They're like little things like that I noticed like the whole way through. So I thought it was really well shot. You know, I certainly deserved its best cinematography nod. But the editing's fantastic too. Like those pool montages, like that's. It romanticizes the game of pool as more than a skill game, as an art almost.
Yeah, certainly there's elements that Jackie Gleason and Paul Newman bring to that, like when they're shooting with confidence, like literally they're, you know, chalk shoot, and yeah. It's like really quick succession, and you know, you can tell there's a handful of edits, but you know, you could tell that they weren't like amateur players themselves. So.
Well, Newman was. Newman had never picked up a pool cue in his life prior to...
He's impressive.
Yeah, prior to getting cast in this movie. And he was tutored by the world champ at the time, Willie Moscone. And I hope I'm getting that right. I'll look it up real quick while we're talking. So he had put a pool table in his house so that he could practice for a couple of months ahead of time. And he got to be, you know, a pretty good player, but it has been said many times by many different people that Jackie Gleason could have been a professional, that he was that good. And you can really tell the way that Rawson and his cinematographer frame, there's a lot more close-up shots of Newman when he's shooting pool and a lot more wide shots of Jackie Gleason. Yeah. Because he did not need help. He could just run around the table and do it the whole time. And it kind of works for that character because, you know, Newman, when he sees him for the first time, you know, this is before, it's not before television, but Newman had never met, or I shouldn't say Newman, Fast Eddie had never met Minnesota Fats. So when he meets Minnesota Fats for the first time and they go head to head, he's in awe of the talent that Minnesota Fats has. And there's that shot where Charlie's trying to talk to him in his ear, and he kind of brushes Charlie off, and he just stares at him, and he's like, "Look at that fat man move around the table like a dancer," and that's a testament to how good Gleason was, and you know Newman I'm sure was fine, but he was, you know, he,
I mean, there's a level, yeah.
Yeah, he was no pro, and a lot of the trick shots were handled by Moscone, where they would do close-ups of the hands.
Yeah,
uh-huh. It wasn't Newman. But for me, that doesn't take anything away to what Newman brings to the movie. I mean, he's really good.
What do you want me to do? Just step out in the alley? Is that it? Big John, do you think this boy is a hustler? Sausage, rack him up.
Eddie, look, I've got troubles, and I think maybe you've got troubles. Maybe it'd be better if we just leave each other alone.
I got my things over at the hotel. I'll bring them over later. Come here.
I'm not sure. I don't know.
Well, what do you want to know? And why?
You're hearing a rain check, and I know it. You're hanging on by your nails. Let that glory whistle ring out loud and clear for Eddie, and you're a wreck on a railroad track. Your horse had finished last. Now, don't make trouble, Miss Ladybug. Live and let live. While you can.
You tell your boys they better kill me, Bert. They better go all the way with me. Because if they just bust me up, put all those pieces back together again, and then so help me. So help me God, Bert. I'm gonna come back here and I'm gonna kill you.
I think George C. Scott is fantastic in this
yes,
movie.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a big George C. Scott fan in general.
And to be honest, like I said, I hadn't seen him before. I did not realize he was in this film until his name popped up at the opening credits.
Yeah, he's great as Burt Gordon. He's the money guy. He's a gentleman gambler himself. They never established that he actually has a job or career outside of where he fronts money for players and takes a cut, for being the financier. When he meets Fast Eddie, he immediately calls him a loser.
Born loser.
Yeah. Which is essentially like the thing that sticks in Eddie's crawl and really starts his downfall. That first night at Ames.
Trying to prove him wrong.
Yeah. He's so taken aback by the idea that he's beating Minnesota Fats and beating him well, and this guy can just look at him and go, nope, he's a loser. He's gonna run out of gas and you got him. Later when they become partners, Bert's like a leech. He sticks to the people who can get him far and he uses them to get money and drains them of all their power. That final scene, that's one of the, I love Strangelove, and George C. Scott is amazing in Strangelove. But when I think of George C. Scott, almost always the first thing that pops into my head is that last scene in The Hustler when he screams, Eddie, you owe me money. That's just,
Yeah, well, that's such an odd, that scene, because during, the game, the final game, plus that montage, when he first sees Eddie at the beginning of that sequence, he's very afraid.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, intense.
Well, we haven't really gone through and talked about any of the story that leads up to that, which we probably should do, but.
Are we going to do this with spoilers as well?
Yeah, well, it's...
Might as well. It's an old... I mean, it's a
65-year-old movie.
You guys have had your chance.
Or 55-year-old movie, sorry. It's a 55-year-old movie. Math is hard.
You mentioned earlier that, when George C. Scott makes his appearance, at the time, Newman's character is beating Minnesota Fats.
Right.
Okay.
Which is what initially is interesting to him. Otherwise, he probably would not have quit his poker game and gone up to see the pool game.
Okay. Are we going to go through, like, story elements?
I was just interjecting.
Okay. Yeah,
keep
we're going through. Okay.
Keep going.
All right. Okay. Well, once he shows up, he immediately, maybe not immediately, but he certainly becomes a noticeable presence within the dynamic of the game. He's not playing. He's sitting with Fats, but he certainly has influence. Like, there's a moment towards the end of, like, that first game that they have where his mere presence starts to eat at Fast Eddie.
Yeah.
So I think that pretty much sets up his role, his character in the whole film, because he's kind of maybe not omniscient, but he's a presence that has a lot of control.
Yeah, well, I mean, as soon as he walks into the pool room, everyone knows who he is except for Eddie and Charlie. Like, you know,
he's
well known in New York, you know, probably in more than one circle. And yeah, that scene where, you know, Fast Eddie is, you know, he's tired, he's sort of disheveled, he's sweaty, he's, you know, and he says to Bert that, you know, can you move? You've been sitting in the exact same spot for hours and it's bothering me. And then Bert, of course, says, sure, and doesn't think twice about it and slides the chair over like 6 inches and sits back down. and that is like, he knows how to get under Eddie's skin immediately, which he does to every other character, you know, throughout the film. You know, he does that to Eddie. He does it to Sarah. He does it to Finley, played by Murray Hamilton later in the film.
You know, there's a lot of moments, I guess you could assume, like, the background of his character, because, you know, it's never clearly defined, but, like, he's certainly observational.
Yeah.
So he's certainly one of those guys that, you know, he's working people out in his mind, but, you know, he seems to be on the dot whenever he comes to his conclusions, so.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, I think Scott's great in this. He's perfect. Yeah, I mean, the other main player that, you know, we've mentioned but haven't really talked about, you mentioned her, Piper Laurie, who plays Sarah Packard. And Sarah is, well, she's a really unusual character, I think, actually. Yeah, she has some sort of ailment, which they don't get into, and, like, she walks with a limp. So she, you know, she's crippled in a way physically, you know, which, so she can't work, I guess. She goes to school and her father essentially pays for everything for her. So she comes from money, but she's a lush, you know, she's.
Yeah, it's a term they use in the film quite a bit.
Yeah. You know, she lives the life that, you know, we see a lot now in, you know, modern
man children.
Modern people, you know, living, you know, off of other people, you know, not wanting to grow up, not wanting to get a job.
Yeah, she's certainly the type of person who's reliant on others.
But I like her in the movie quite a bit. And her, you know, her character recognizes something in Eddie, and Eddie recognizes something in her that sort of draws them together. I'm not sure that they were ever really meant to be together. You know, like, I get the feeling like, you know, what happens later in the film, if it wasn't that, something else would have torn them apart. Like, I kind of feel like they were just sort of, you know, passing each other's trajectories, you know, and for that moment, you know, they needed each other, and, you know, that would have ended regardless of whether Sarah lives or not.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, but I think in the film, certainly, you know, movies are always kind of like a cross-section of time. You know, they're not always meant to be, you know, happily ever after, or, you know, the way it ends is the way it stays. Especially, you know, with Eddie being a character who's kind of on the go. He really doesn't have roots, so.
Yeah, there's no mention of family or anything.
Yeah,
like
certainly.
That.
There's also that, you mentioned that they were probably going to be torn apart sometime down the line. That's actually a line that Bert says, like He says it at one of the final scenes, right?
Yeah.
When Eddie brings up Sarah.
Yeah. Yeah, he's something to the effect of, it wasn't now, would have been 3 years from now, yeah. You know.
So what else about Piper Laurie?
She and Eddie have a relationship, of course. You know, Eddie is falling on hard times. You know, he has, he's had a falling out with Charlie over money. So he's sort of, you know, shacked up with Sarah. He does some small time hustles. He meets Bert again. Bert tries to convince him to come out on the road for a 25% cut of whatever they win. And Eddie initially tells him no, that he's not interested in a 25% cut, and that they would raise the 25% to 50% or more, that he might be willing. And Bert says that he won't negotiate. So that's the end of it. So Eddie kind of bounces around, hustles a few places, and he gets himself into a little bit of trouble when he embarrasses someone pretty badly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's trying to hustle this guy who's also sort of a low grade, maybe shark himself. When that guy, you know, pisses Eddie off and rubs him the wrong way, you know, Eddie unleashes the full talent of his arsenal of pool skills and beats him flat, you know, like 10 games of 9 ball straight.
Yeah.
And so it's $100, right?
Yeah, it's definitely 10 straight, so.
Yeah, it's 10 games, $10 a game, $100 freeze out. I think that's what it was. And so once the money's on the pool table, he's surrounded by a bunch of other guys, and, you know, it's very clear what's about to happen, and they end up breaking his thumbs. So he has a few months where he essentially lives with Sarah. Depends on Sarah, you know, for little things that he can't do for himself. The romance blossoms. You know, he opens himself up to her, I think probably more than he's ever opened himself up to anybody, talking about his fears and his desires. There's a really nice scene where they have a picnic, and he's talking about how great it feels when he's really humming along around a pool table, mm-hmm. You know,
when he's in his groove.
Yeah. And then he mentions how, you know, Bert called him a loser, and Sarah says, the way, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but the way you talk about this, you know, you're obviously not a loser. You're not a loser at all. And I think that's a very important piece of the theme to the film. You know, the idea that, you know, watching it now, that there's a dynamic between their desire to have money and wealth and be respected for Eddie, and the idea that that is probably never going to bring him happiness. Whereas if, you know, like those couple of months with Sarah, when he couldn't shoot and when he, you know, had for a time a regular relationship with somebody, that might have been the greatest point in his life.
Greatest point so far.
Maybe. Yeah. 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 Well, we're not talking about Color of Money, so I refuse to talk about Color of Money. I'm not sorry, Scorsese. You can put that in with After Hours and Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore and shove it off to Mars or the moon or somewhere.
You know, you're talking about that picnic scene. I think Piper Laurie, that's probably one of her best scenes in the entire film. You know, she's in that moment, she's very patient. She listens. She asks him questions because, you know, there's a point later in the film when they say, you know, what are we doing? We're living in, like, depravity. Is that the word she uses? Depravity or sin? But in that moment, you know, it definitely feels like they could just be, you know, maybe not just, you know, a lush and a hustler, but, you know, a regular couple.
Right.
You know, and that's the moment where she says she loves him. Now, you know,
he can't say back to her.
Yeah, in that instant, yeah. She says it twice.
Mm-hmm.
And she says she'll wait for him to say it. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, at that point, they go out on the road together. You know, once he gets his cast off and starts shooting pool again, he runs into Bert again. and changes his mind. You know, I think the line is, you know, 25% cut of something big is better than a, you know,
0% cut of nothing.
Yeah. So
100% cut of nothing.
Right. So Bert takes them to Kentucky for the Kentucky Derby because, you know, that's all the gamblers are there and people who you know, want to spend big money. And they arrange a game with a gentleman named Finley, played by Murray Hamilton, who most people know as the mayor from Jaws. When they get to his home, they schedule this game. They get to his home, they realize that the pool table doesn't have pockets and that he plays carom billiards and not pool. So Bert initially wants to, you know, pull out and not have Eddie play because he doesn't want to risk the money, you know, and he asks Eddie, have you ever played billiards before? And I think Eddie's response is, well, sure, how hard could it be?
Well, he says initially yes.
Yeah.
He says yes just straight out. So flat out lies. And then later on, you know, Bert asks him again and, you know, Eddie changes his answer slightly.
Yeah. But, you know, so they play, you know, they play a few games, they lose. You know, Eddie starts to get a feel for it and he senses that he can probably still take Finley. Bert initially says no. Eddie says that he's going to go up and he's going to get his own money and play. So he goes up and takes the money out of Sarah's bag and comes back down. And once Sarah comes down, she tries to convince him to leave. And when Eddie gets upset and tells her to go away, that's when Bert sees, like, that fire in Eddie and agrees to front him to play the rest of the time. And they end up taking Finley for $12,000?
12, yeah.
Yeah.
Because 25% of the 12 is the staking.
The $3,000, right. So yeah, Eddie decides he's going to walk back. Bert takes a taxi and gets there beforehand and has an incident with Sarah where it is clear that they have a sexual encounter. And Sarah commits suicide. But before she does, she recalls something she says to Eddie earlier, which is that the people he surrounds him with are twisted, perverted, and crippled, which I think is a bit ironic because she's physically crippled, but they are mentally crippled. And she writes those three words on the mirror in lipstick before she kills herself. So when Eddie comes back, Bert, you know, the police are there, and this is the first time we ever see Bert unraveled. You know, his composure is broken for the first time ever. And, you know, he doesn't understand what has happened, and he's upset, and Eddie walks in, and you know, Bert tries to explain and says he's sorry, and Eddie walks in and sees Sarah's body. That is the moment that changes Eddie's life forever, I guess, you know. So he finally understands, I think at least, you know, and that he's lost something for the first time that had a greater value than money.
And it's something he can't get back.
Right. You know, and that leads into the final act of the film, not even really an act, but the final scene where he returns to Ames to play Minnesota Fats one game for the whole $3,000 and proceeds to, you know, beat the pants off of him until Minnesota Fats quits, which recalls the point earlier in the movie when Charlie tries to get him to leave when he's like, I don't know, he's like $10,000 up.
$18,000.
Yeah, well, that was later. Okay. But he's $10,000 up, and Charlie's like, you got what you wanted. Let's get out of here. The game is over. And he says, the game isn't over until Minnesota Fats says it's over. And so finally, at the end of the picture, Minnesota Fats realizes, you know, at that point that he is beaten. He says that he quits. Finally gives Eddie what he wants. And it's clear that, you know, although he's victorious, he's still broken in a way, you know. And he has an altercation,
which we talked about a little bit earlier.
Yeah, with Bert. Bert expects a cut of the money he's won from Minnesota Fats, You know, when he refuses, Bert says that, you know, essentially they're going to break his arms. Eddie says, you know, you better kill me then, because when you put all those pieces back together, you know, I'm going to come after you and I'm going to kill you. Bert essentially says, okay, fine, Eddie, you know, keep your money, but don't ever walk into a pool room ever again. You're not going to be welcome in any big time pool room ever. So the thing that he loved doing the most, he would have to give up for his principles at that point. The principles, newly acquired principles.
Well, he does make a point. I mean, we addressed, like, the idea that, you know, this is just in these moments. But he does say that he loved Sarah
right
at a time. So he says it right before he talks about the, you know, the fact that he's going to come after him if he's, you know, if they break his arms or whatever.
Right.
So, you know, did you get the impression that that Bert also had, you know, a pang of guilt, you know, in that moment when he says he loved her?
Yeah,
or is he totally, like, unrepentant?
I think the Bert character is definitely guilty, a bit. You know, I think Bert is like Eddie, trying to scrape back together, like, what he thought he once was. And I think that moment kind of took a piece away from Bert. So I don't think he's the same character. You know, I think he, whether he would want to admit it or not, has a little bit more personality himself, the way that Eddie does. But he has become, like, less arrogant, maybe, as a result of it. I think, you know, the way Scott plays it, Bert is 100% controlled all the time until Louisville. And then after that night, there's a fear in him that wasn't there before, almost. Not just because of Eddie, but because of just being involved in something like that in general. Mm-hmm. Like, that's, you know, it's a black mark on his reputation almost. I'm not sure he actually really cares about Eddie at all. So I'm not sure that,
it's just a recall for that moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, he made a mistake. And, you know, as a result, somebody lost their life.
Yeah, well, it's maybe not necessarily personal guilt, but it's, you know, it's just, you said black mark. Yeah, I think maybe that's probably the best way to put it. Well, what do you think? Okay, there's a moment. Maybe this is jumping back a bit. It certainly is.
It's okay.
But, like, there's a moment where they're at the party and where Eddie and Sarah get separated. She throws a fit because Bert whispers something to her. But
yeah,
what do you, like, I mean, I guess it could be anything. You could kind of put anything, considering what, at that point, you already know what kind of character it is. But, like, what do you think he might have said to her?
Oh, I have no idea, but there's a, I can't remember if it's on the special edition DVD, but Piper Laurie recalls that scene in an interview that I saw at one point, where she said that the script essentially just says that, you know, Bert whispers in her ear and she gets upset. And so they tried to, like, work out, you know, what it would be. And it came time to shoot. And apparently George C. Scott just says, there's nothing that I can say that will infuriate you more than what you could imagine that I would say, or something like that. And so he didn't say anything. So she had to, like, get that reaction on her own.
She had to actually drink all this alcohol first.
Yeah.
It's a lot too.
Well, it's funny because Piper Laurie, I can't remember. I think she might have made one movie after this, and then she, like, 15 years went by before she made another movie, and she came out of retirement to make Carrie.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember why, if it was family related.
Maybe she was married and she retired briefly.
She's pretty good in Carrie too.
Yeah.
Even though I'm not a huge fan of that movie. So. But I kind of feel like, you know, we lost some time with her. Like, maybe she would have been a bigger star.
I mean, I think Piper Laurie is still a recognizable name, though.
Yeah.
If you're talking about older Hollywood, so pulling up.
I was gonna check her IMDb. Yeah, after The Hustler, she did a couple of TV movies. Appeared on a couple of TV shows in the 60s, like Naked City, Bob Hope Presents. But yeah, the next major theatrical movie was Carrie. Always one of those, like, you know, what might have been scenarios.
Yeah, it looks like she was married to a writer named Joe Morgenstern, and then she didn't work while they were married, but when they divorced, she went back to work.
Mm. Well.
He stole her from us.
Yep. He sure did. 15 years worth. It's crazy. You know, another thing I like about that last scene is the way Jackie Gleason plays Fats in it.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to the way he plays it, you know, very, very, even when he's losing in the early parts of the movie, like, he never sort of breaks the Minnesota Fats character. He's confident, cool. I love that scene where they have, like, a break after a game, and he goes into the bathroom, and he powders himself back up.
He shaves, towels off.
Yeah, does everything you could do, and then he comes out looking so, like, perfect and manicured, and he's like, all right, Fast Eddie, let's play some pool. So, you know, he's ready to, you know.
Powders up his hands.
Yeah, he's ready to go. In the final scene, it's the lowest we see him. Like, he sits in a chair a lot in the original, like, the opening scenes. But even when he's losing, the camera still looks up at him. It's still a low-angle shot. But at the end of the film, it's a more of a high-angle shot. So that, you know, you could see not only he's been beaten, but that, you know, that he feels beaten also, you know. And I like the fact that... when Bert says, you know, that you owe me money, and they go through that whole thing, you know, Fats, in a very reluctant but almost, like, paternal way, says, you know, you better give him the money, Eddie. Yeah. Like, he doesn't say it like, I'm going to help him beat the shit out of you or anything like that. He says it in a way like I know from experience, yeah. Like, you better pay this guy. Like, if you don't, you're going to be sorry. And, you know, and of course, you know, Eddie, you know, has some nice words to say to Fats before he leaves. And,
it's a good scene. I think the acknowledgement from a guy that he respects so much, at that point means so much to him.
Yeah. I like that he's drinking at the point when Eddie says, you play a great game of pool, Fats. And he just kind of like tips the glass up at him and he says, you too, Fast Eddie. it's a good shot. So, but it's like, it's very, you know, I don't know if anybody would consider The Hustler a noir, but like, it's very noirish. I think the music, you know, being sort of jazzy in a way, it lends itself to that. I like the idea that you know, that you're dealing with flawed characters. You're dealing with people that are. I wouldn't say seedy,
but certainly maybe, like, you know, kind of underbelly.
Yeah.
It's a whole different world. Than,
right. You know. It's, you know, there's no 9-to-5ers there. You know, they're all night owls. They all hustle. They all, you know,
daytime drink.
Yeah. They're gambling. And it's got, I think, one of the great endings personally. You know, I mean, when a character wins, but loses, it's a tough thing to pull off in anything. And going back to, you know, White Men Can't Jump, you know, like the Billy Ho character, you know, he ultimately gets exactly what I'm just realizing this at this moment, but the ending of that movie is like The Hustler.
Rucker Park and loses Rosie Perez.
So he wins the big game. He gets what he wants ultimately, but in the process of doing that, he loses, you know, he loses his woman. He loses that.
Are they married?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
No. Not in White Man Can't Jump. Yeah.
Okay.
No, Wesley Snipes is married in that movie. But that's a very different dynamic there. But But I think the Hustler is very noirish. Like it's not shot with like chiaroscuro lighting, but you know, I think
thematically, maybe just you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't consider it noir because it's all shot on location and it's not expressionistic in the way that like early noirs are, like especially the RKO noirs. But there are those mid-range noirs like Naked City that kind of like turned a corner from formalism into realism, and I think The Hustler is sort of a realistic looking noir movie.
Okay, I can see that.
Maybe that's one of the reasons why I grew to like noir movies a lot.
Because I was such
a fan of The Hustler as a young.
So there was young this man. Was kind of like
a. It was a formative viewing experience for me.
Yeah, it's a film noir, not 1.0, but like 0.80 for you into it.
Yes.
Gateway noir starter. All right, final thoughts, I guess, of The Hustler. I mean, I liked it immensely for someone who had never seen it before, and you loved it quite a bit from a very young age. So I mean, it's
mostly
a terrific film.
When I was a kid, mostly I just tried to recreate trick shots and stuff. I was like, oh, I'm gonna do that, like
do the masse.
Yeah,
they're doing the masses and.
Luckily, I never ripped the felt on my own pool table, but man, that's a tough shot, man. Doing masse is really, really difficult. So
that's why Ames has a sign that says no masse shots.
No one ever pays attention. No like masse it's shots funny. Ever. Like I didn't look at any of my notes while we were talking, actually, which maybe I should have. It might have gone more smoothly, but like you know, I took like a half a page of notes. There they are, right there. And but one of the things was like I thought it was hilarious. Like they have all these signs around Ames.
No gambling. No gambling.
No gambling, no mess.
No alcohol.
Yeah.
send someone down and get me a bottle of bourbon.
They break every one of those rules.
You can do it if you're Minnesota Fats or Burt.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Those signs are just for the popo.
Yeah.
No legal gambling here, sir.
Actually, I meant to do a little research on that, but I'm pretty sure Ames's Billiards is closed. But I think they were open until the 80s. I think they were open for a while. I don't have a pool table anymore, but you know, I'd love to get one back. So
it's Baltimore. There's plenty of pool halls, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. That's a seedy joint, though. Go to a pool hall. That's yeah.
You want to be the Hustler?
No, I don't want to be the Hustler. I don't want my thumbs broken. I had enough fingers broken already from all kinds of different things. Crooked. I got nothing but crooked fingers. They're all over the place.
Crooked fingers, man.
Crooked fingers. That's the name of the podcast. There you go.
Crooked fingers.
Well, that'll be my nickname, Crooked Fingers, and we have to figure out what your nickname is.
Crooked. Okay, yeah. Let's see. Maybe I'll get a name from Sorcerer.
Well, yeah.
Serrano.
Yeah, I looked up what the truck names meant in Spanish.
Yeah.
So... we'll get to that.
Well, one begins with an R. I don't remember what it.
I don't remember, but I wrote it down. So, yeah.
You want to take us out?
Yeah. Hopefully that wasn't too painful for everybody. Sorry, we're very very rusty. But we'll get better.
Speaking about rust, I guess we're going to talk about Sorcerer next, right? Those trucks are pretty rusty.
Yes. Yeah. That's a great movie, but we'll leave that discussion for the next episode. So hey, if you weren't bored out of your mind, and
these are some growing pains here.
If you didn't mind all the ums and uhs and dead silence on occasion while we looked up things on IMDb, which yeah, maybe we'll trim down. Maybe we'll trim those out.
Yeah, yeah. You probably should.
Yeah, I'll go through this with a fine tooth comb, make us look good. But, you know, hey, come back next week for, we're going to be talking about William Friedkin's 1977 film Sorcerer, starring Roy Scheider, based on The Wages of Fear. So it should be a good time. We're gonna get into it. It's going to be sweaty and...
That's what it is right
sweaty
now.
Sweaty and really tense.
And filthy.
Yes. And so, you know, join us for that. That'll be a fun time. So where can people find you on the internet?
Oh, well, you can...
Filmsmash.com?
www.filmsmash.com.
Or what's your Twitter handle?
Junior Beho, at Junior Beho.
At Junior Beho. And for me, you can find me at Setting the Frame on Twitter or settingtheframe.blogspot.com for my intermittent, whatever.
Updates.
You should probably not even check that. Just find me on Twitter.
Updates or what have you.
Yeah. I haven't written anything since Avengers came out. Or Civil War.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, Civil War. Yeah. It's Avengers.
Avengers.
Come on, let's face it.
Captain America, Avengers.
Captain America.
Avenger fight.
/ Avengers 2.5. So, more Infinity Stones to come. All right, well, that's it. We're done. We'll see you later.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah. Thanks for joining us.